Welcome to my channel or welcome back to my channel. My name is Zach. I'm the Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos. And today I am giving unsolicited advice to your favorite pop stars, your least favorite pop stars, my favorite pop stars, my least favorite pop stars. I used to do this fun little series on TikTok where I would give pop stars, and that's a loose and general term because I did give advice to James Charles. I would give aspiring musicians, shall we say, advice on where I think their career should go next. What are my qualifications? Absolutely none. I am just a talking head on the internet. I am a critic, I am a perceiver, a consumer, a lover of pop music. And I would say that's where my credentials to give advice on what I'd like to see comes for more than anything else. Just the fact that I love pop music and I have been loving it for a long time. And I think that I have good taste. Of course I think I have good taste, otherwise why would I be sharing it with you? But these are all very non-serious, vague suggestions, just my vision of where I would like to see all of these artists go in the future. And if you like this video, make sure to subscribe because I know that a lot of you are coming back every week and you're not subscribing. That don't make no sense, love. Subscribe. I don't have a script for today's video, by the way. I am literally just shooting the breeze, telling you what is coming to my mind, these holy dispatches that come when I rant and rave. I don't do unscripted videos a lot anymore, and I think that they show a different side to me. They give a little key, so let's have a key. My first piece of advice for a pop star is for Ed Sheeran. Ed Sheeran, I know that we've gone back and forth, and I've said some pretty harsh things about your current musical exploits, such as your creative brain is a squirrel operating an iPad inside your head and banging cymbals together. I would not like to walk that back, and I would like to give the advice of retire. Thank you. Justin Bieber, here is your unsolicited pop star advice from the Swiftologist. I didn't like Justin Bieber's Coachella set, and I think that is because I'm attached to a version of Justin Bieber that he really is not interested in performing anymore, and that's kind of my problem, and I need to let it go. And I also need to remember that when Swag came out, I had a positive reaction to it overall. It really felt like a project or like an artistic direction that I think he hasn't had in a while. It was his first project without Scooter Braun, so that for sure added a creative layer and a dynamic to it that I think was very freeing to him. You'll notice that the Swag era didn't really have any music videos or promotion. It just dropped. And to his credit, it was a success. People really liked it. And in general, what surprised me, I think people overall did like Justin Bieber's Coachella set. One man's trash is another man's treasure. If you want to see someone stomping angrily around to a Diva Cup on stage designed by Rode, that is completely your choice. I think where the split is kind of interesting is that we really are in this very big nostalgia moment. Every artist is leveraging or relying on their nostalgia to a certain extent. Taylor with the Eras Tour, Miley Cyrus with the Hannah Montana reunion, Demi Lovato reuniting the Camp Rock cast. And Justin Bieber is one of the colleagues of that generation of artists that is now coming around to sort of be a nostalgia act as well. And of course, Justin Bieber was absolutely huge when he was a much younger artist, arguably bigger than he is now. He was a global phenomenon, Bieber fever. There was so much going on around Justin Bieber and his music that it's difficult to have all of these nostalgic experiences and completely pretend that Justin Bieber is not part of that at all and receive him totally like a new artist, which I think is how he would like to be received at this very moment in time. I think it seems to me that his relationship to his prior catalog is not as fond as someone like Miley Cyrus, who has had her own issues with the Hannah Montana period, but seems to have like made some peace with it. Taylor Swift, obviously, the Eras Tour was about reclaiming all of our past selves and refusing to feel ashamed or cringe about things. Justin Bieber's relationship to his prior catalog, and I'm only guessing because he hasn't spoken about this, I think is a bit more complicated because he was plucked from obscurity at such a young age and forced onto this treadmill that I don't think he even really knew was something he could get off of for such a long time. He was not really that involved in his creative process for, I would say, at least 70% of his career. So maybe songs like Baby and Beauty and a Beat and One Time don't fill him with the kind of nostalgic glee that we get from hearing it. Maybe he feels a pain. Maybe he feels an understanding that this experience was something no one else will ever understand because it was so painful for him. Again, we give a lot of automatic grace to men's imagined pain and not a lot of grace to women's real pain, but that is a topic for another day. All of this to say, I don't think Justin Bieber cares to be a nostalgia artist, and so I really think he should just drop it entirely. I feel like his Coachella set really should have just skipped the karaoke portion of the show and just done Swag front to back. It would have been a more cohesive and clear statement. If we had to divide Justin Bieber's career into like an old Justin versus a new Justin kind of a moment, I guess the old Justin would end with the release of Purpose. Everything after that to me is kind of New Testament Justin Bieber, where he's not automatically this like big dominating force in pop culture anymore and has to work a little bit harder to make a moment and not just rely on being a young heartthrob and Bieber fever. And we get a couple of confused projects after that. There is Changes, which was a resounding cricket and a big flop. And we also get Justice. And Justice is a really interesting project for Justin Bieber because it felt like his last hurrah was Scooter Braun. It was his very last attempt at being the kind of superstar and celebrity that Scooter Braun was really good at creating. That template of marketing your music, of being everywhere all at once, of strong-arming radio and places into making you the biggest thing in the world, that doesn't really seem to be a template that works in the music industry now. Thank God Scooter Braun's mode of marketing and managing artists actually has fallen out of favor. So the Justice moment confused me because it really reminded me of the Beauty and the Beat Justin, of the Sorry Justin, the Justin that could make these really indelible, like fun, big pop songs and dance and give it all and give energy. But I think what we're seeing from Justin Bieber is a real hesitance towards ever doing that again. And that is so fair. But I think it's a really difficult challenge to square this pretty long discography you already have with this new direction that you're going in. And one good thing about that over-controlled and overproduced and very regimented pop era style that Justice or maybe Purpose had is that it gives you some like creative parameters to work within. When you have too much freedom, and this is with any creative exploit or project whatsoever, guidelines, format, structure, those things actually really help you condense and get to the best parts of your ideas. Being really freewheeling with your creativity and just doing whatever because you can yield some interesting results, but you then have to apply the structure on it, in my opinion, in hindsight. So if you create in the way that Taylor Swift is creating, you know, her automatic songwriting thing, Lana Del Rey does this, Justin Bieber seems to be doing this with the very quick release of Swag 2, which was a significant abomination in terms of quality compared to the first Swag record, you have to, after you're done letting it all out, take a step back and see how you can push it all into something, into an idea, into a vision that feels more cohesive. Swag would be a much better album if it was about 9 songs shorter. That's just too much bloat to be walking into this whole new I'm a real artist era with. So my wishes for Justin Bieber would be fully let go of the nostalgia stuff if you don't want to do it. Let's not leave the people blue-balled. And also, you know, I think it would be freeing for him to just fully divorce himself from his prior catalog. He sold his music, like he's ready to move on to the next thing, clearly. So I would say ditch the nostalgia stuff and focus on being a little bit more disciplined with your songwriting. Focus on a project, an idea. Swag was a cool experiment, but I would really like him to see this new approach that he's taken to creating music and focus it on a vision. I've never seen Justin Bieber really dial in on a vision that wasn't created for him. So I would be curious to see how he could apply these new skills that he's learned from this, you know, very generative period of Swag 1 and Swag 2 and actually make something interesting out of it. And I'm also going to say, take your time. I'm going to say, take your time. And you don't need to tour, King. You don't need to tour. If you can't handle it, if it's not good for you, don't charge people money to come see you. But again, people were very happy with the Coachella set. If you're going to a Justin Bieber concert, I think it's totally fair to do Swag front to back, but this was not a Justin Bieber concert. Anyway, Justin Bieber, there's your free advice from me. Also, we would like to see some visuals. Let me just state that for the record. Justin Bieber is sexy when he wants to be. He's hot. He also likes fashion, apparently. He's into his clothes. Why don't we see it? I would like to see a little bit more of it. I can also, everything he seems to be doing right now is a reaction to, I think, being so overexposed, overproduced, overphotographed, really treated like a product for the longest time. And I think he clearly wants to be reassessed as a musician first, hence hiding throughout his entire Coachella set and not really giving us a smile very often. But you know, you're still a pop star. You're still doing pop music. And if you want to stay in pop music, I think we need to be using the moneymaker, the face, a little bit more. Let's talk about Gracie Abrams, who is currently threatening to release new music. I think that Gracie Abrams is at a much scarier crossroads than many of the pop stars of her ilk, of her generation are right now, because there isn't that much to hold on to, and yet she's had a huge moment. But that moment really relies on one song. That's So True. That's So True was a runaway hit. Does it make sense? Well, no, not really. Is it an undeniable tongue twister, energetic, effervescent moment that you just want to scream, sing along to whenever you hear it? Well, yes. And why is that? I think we know the answer. The answer is a gorgeous woman called Audrey Hobart, who has launched her own solo career this year and has launched into the stratosphere, in my opinion. I love Sue Me. I thought the entire project was so interesting. One of the big takeaways I had from Who's the Clown was Gracie Abrams is really borrowing a lot of Audrey Hobart's swag. Audrey Hobart is doing a lot more than Gracie Abrams is doing in terms of bringing personality to the songs on the Gracie Abrams tracks that they co-write together. Risk, and That's So True, I keep saying this over and over, are the best Gracie Abrams songs because I think they go away from this very sort of boilerplate, template singer-songwriter. I'm going to sit in my room and write vague platitudes. You guys know how I feel about that specific kind of vague diaristic songwriting that Gracie Abrams does. Gracie isn't a great melodic songwriter. She's kind of good at observational details here and there. The reason why I don't think she's a Tay Daughter is because Taylor has an excellent ear for melody, and her songs that do have observational diaristic qualities also have infectious hooks and melodies. Gracie Abrams doesn't quite have that ear that Taylor has for a marketing jingle, also something that makes a pop song catchy. A lot of Gracie's work is boring and sleepy, and I know that her fans are going to disagree with me, but the critical reception speaks for itself, and the fact that she's not really been able to yield many hits beyond That's So True and maybe Close to You, perhaps. Risk wasn't even that big of a hit. I Love You, I'm Sorry, that's a song that has a melody, has an interesting-ish melody to carry it through. The rest of her songs kind of blend together because it doesn't have that like textural melodic difference. And that's where Audrey Hobart comes in, because Audrey Hobart, I think, has an excellent ear for melody. She especially has an excellent ear for cadence and phrasing, and helping give Gracie this sort of like hurried, rushed, gasping, I'm giving you a verbal download of everything that I need you to know right now, and it's instant and it's urgent, that forms a very parasocial connection with the listener. She brings that to the Gracie Abrams tracks, and I think that Gracie delivers it very well. And something that I think that Gracie gets at in a lot of her work, but maybe is a bit underexplored, is this sort of like hyper-specific, messy girl vibe. Side characters, really precise details, this self-flagellating self-awareness. Made It Out Alive, But I Think I Lost It, Said That I Was Fine, Said It From My Coffin. This is ridiculous and it's melodramatic, but it works and it feels urgent and true. And I think that the chorus of Risk also has that too. God, I'm actually invested. It sounds like she is exclaiming, almost in a religious way. And that energy doesn't come through on most of her bodies of work. It happens in fits and spurts. And I think if she dialed into that a little bit more, it would make people connect and grab on to her pop songwriting in a much more robust and developed way. The Gracie Abrams songs that I like and end up being hits have this kind of call and response line. I love you, I'm sorry, I miss you, I'm sorry. They have these ad-libs and overlapping lines. It feels like your friend is talking to you on FaceTime and kind of giving you a very intimate insight into their romantic adventure they had on vacation. Not a polished monologue, not a really formal, well-written, writerly song, which I think is what Gracie tries to affect and do a lot of the time. She needs to show us that she has an ear for musicality, not just an eye for observation and detail. So I think she needs to pay whatever it's going to take to get Audrey Hobart back in the studio with her. I don't know if they're going to be working together again. The risk that Gracie now runs into is that I think this breakthrough that she's found of style, of cadence, of emotion, of feeling has really come from Audrey Hobart, and Audrey Hobart is doing it better on her own work. So is there a way where Gracie and Audrey can kind of meet in the middle between what they're both good at and find something that feels distinctly their collaborative voice instead of just Gracie's? Unfortunately, Gracie is really attached to the Taylor Swift model of I am the sole author or I am the songwriter. I want everybody to view these as my stories and my perspectives. That doesn't really mesh well with prolonged creative collaborator that is the same age as me and also releasing music at the same time. I think if we're really going to try and get a hit, a duet could do favors for both of these girls. It would have Gracie kind of overtly acknowledging that Audrey is definitely a sonic influence to her, and also make her look like an equal instead of someone that's working behind the scenes and puppeting her. And it helps Audrey get exposure to a different audience. I would be really interested to hear a collaboration with them come through on whatever Gracie's next project is. I need her to get away from Aaron Dessner as well. Aaron Dessner works best with people who have a very clear vision of what they want to achieve. You will find that his work becomes very dreary, very dull, very boring when he's working with someone who is looking to him to be the shining light of how the music should sound. He's fundamentally not a pop producer or a pop songwriter, and it worked for Taylor Swift because Taylor Swift brings to the table this melodic math, this approach to pop, this approach to songwriting that even when she's writing in atypical ways for her, she's still working in very rigid and traditional song structures. Gracie Abrams doesn't have that same familiarity with the pop canon nor the experience in writing that kind of material. So when she comes together with Aaron, it really does feel like the indie auteur leading the pop blind. And they come together and they maximize their joint no pop music to be had slay. On That's So True, Aaron is not a songwriter and he is a producer, but he is also assisted by Julian Bonetta, who has worked with Sabrina Carpenter pretty extensively and definitely has more of a grasp on what good pop music should sound like. You see how Aaron Dessner is very capable of creating a catchy indie-ish pop song when there is a melodic songwriter such as Audrey Hobart, another producer who is pop inclined such as Julian Bonetta, working in the room with them. Gracie, free yourself from the shackles of just Aaron Dessner production and co-writing. It's not working. If you two and Taylor Swift can't come together and make a hit by sheer force of the three of you being on the song together, It's not going to happen. Gracie's personal life is also interesting. And if you're going to be a diaristic and confessional songwriter, it would be a grave mistake to refuse to write about your relationships as they are actively happening to you. This was kind of Taylor Swift's secret sauce the entire way through the start of her career, was that there was usually a fresh romance or a fresh heartbreak to discuss and dissect. Gracie's in a bit of a different position because luckily or unluckily for Taylor, by the time her albums about people would come out, she would be broken up with them. So she really felt no duty to keep the relationship going or to keep it alive or to censor herself. But Paul Mescal seems to be very private. I don't know that he would love to be written about in the kind of overt way that a diaristic confessional songwriter like Gracie should be doing. If that influences Gracie's ability to approach her material with the kind of candor that is required of being a diaristic and confessional songwriter, that is just one more barrier to her making an album that actually manages to capture what That's So True had. If you want to have songs about your life, you have to give up some of your right to privacy. It is the Faustian bargain that you must accept. Now, I would like to give some unsolicited pop star advice to Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus, I want you to be more committed to your job. I think that Miley Cyrus is very committed to her persona. The Miley Cyrus brand, the way that she behaves and moves through the world, the attitude that she has, this very, very cool gravity that surrounds everything that she does and she brings to every project, that is well established. The character of Miley Cyrus, I think, is instantly knowable to so many people. She has an iconic look. She has an iconic, very low, husky voice. She's done very many iconic things. She's been a present, active feature of the culture for such a long time. Her image is kind of solid, and I think that it can withstand a lot of different, you know, variations and fluctuations and style without really losing the true essence or sense of who she is. She arrived at something interesting with Something Beautiful. It was a valiant experiment, but I would really like to see her drill down and get a bit more involved in an album process. Any album, pick an album. I would like to see Miley Cyrus, you know, actively being involved in the promotion of her material, doing some live performances. She said many times that touring is stressful to her, but I don't think she has to tour in order to be engaged with her music. Her albums will keep having diminishing returns if she doesn't want to do the work of creating content to support them. Unfortunately, in this day and age, promoting your music is as important to the creative process as the creative process itself. It's a very kind of messed up thing about the way pop music works now, but ultimately Miley Cyrus is making pop music and her record label wants her to have hits. And I think, you know, Miley liked winning that Grammy. I think she would like to have hits too. Something Beautiful didn't seem like a ploy for a hit, that's for sure. It was definitely, I don't want to call it a concept album because it didn't really have a concept. It was a vibe concept album, I would say, executed pretty well. The soundscaping was really beautiful and it was different to anything she'd ever done before. But Miley's issue is that she doesn't invest enough of herself in a project before she moves on to the next thing. And a really good example of this is Endless Summer Vacation. I was just revisiting this yesterday, and I've always viewed it as kind of just a whatever project, maybe like a 6 out of 10. But when I revisited it, I was like, this might be a solid 7. And that doesn't sound like a huge difference now that I'm saying it out loud, but a 7 and a 6 are very, very different in my estimation. This record has a lot of different areas and lanes that Miley could have explored more in subsequent records, or even just more on this record, that she kind of dropped. A song like Jaded builds into this pop rock, California surf rock thing that gels very well with what she's done in the past on something like Younger Now, which is not the best example, but a song like Malibu lives in the same cinematic universe that Jaded lives in. That's a familiar song. Had we had a music video, had we done a little bit of promotion or a live version of this, or had she kept it maybe as a deluxe track and launched a deluxe instead, these things could have extended the shelf life of an album that was pretty much forgotten about as soon as it came out, aside from the one big blockbuster single that it kind of accidentally landed on with Flowers. There's so much to like and admire on this track list. I think that Rose Colored Lenses also fits into that jaded style of song that Miley has done before I was just talking about. I also love River and Violet Chemistry. Miley as the low-voiced, sexy, husky commander of the dance floor, that is something that she has not explored almost ever. She has done fun 2013s like R&B, hip-hop inspired stuff. She's done weird, wacky electronic music. She's done rock and roll. She's done pure pop. But I think that a CXOXO, not to keep bringing that up, not that being my North Star of an experimental album. Miley Cyrus's Worst Girl in America, that's really what Bangers could have been, if you think about it. Something of that ilk with the polish of Violet Chemistry and River would simply be amazing. I also loved the visual that we got for River. I think that was the other music video that we got from this era. But the lack of promotion just allows these albums to languish and for people to forget about them. And now that I was revisiting Endless Summer Vacation, I'm telling you guys, there's something there. You should revisit it now. Miley Cyrus is not going to encourage you to revisit it, but I will. I'll be her promotion for this. Miley's next journey, I think, really would be to put her whole Miley into performing, promoting, embodying, making a world out of her music. I think she has it within her. I don't know if it's of interest to her. And I'm kind of saying, if you're not interested, then don't do it. I'm sick of these half-hearted projects. That's my advice to Selena Gomez, by the way. I didn't even include Selena Gomez in this video because I really don't see a path forward for her being a contemporary, relevant, a good pop star anymore, but Miley has the same issue. It's like, if you're going to put out an album, let's really put out the album. When I think about it, Selena kind of put more effort into I Said I Love You first than Miley Cyrus did into Something Beautiful, which is crazy because Miley clearly put way more work into the creative process of that than Selena Gomez did. It's interesting. I would like to see more from Miley Cyrus. I love you, diva. Please give us tea. Let's talk about someone that came up alongside Miley Cyrus, Demi Lovato. Demi. I was a Lovatic. I went to a Demi Lovato meet and greet. I stood in line for like 9 hours to be front row for her sound check and her show in the Singapore heat. I want Demi Lovato to find her why. Why are you doing this anymore? This turn to clubbing and dance music with It's Not That Deep 100% feels like a response to the market. It feels like a calibrated market response. Brat Summer's popping off. Everybody's having their dance record. The Kesha era is back. People are finding a lot of success with this. I haven't had a hit in a while. Hyperpop adjacent stuff is really popping off. Why don't I throw my hat in the ring? Demi is actually a very capable and competent songwriter. She can write all kinds of songs. I wouldn't say she's excellent, but she's consistently quite good. And I think on all of her projects, you can find a piece of good writing somewhere. She's a pretty decent lyricist. And it also helps that as a person, Demi has a lot of interesting stories to tell. She's been through a lot in her life. Unfortunately, she focuses on a very specific sliver of that experience and repeats it over and over, which at least she's not doing on It's Not That Deep. But It's Not That Deep is so anonymous. She's really struggled to find her true sound throughout the years. Despite being a competent songwriter that has tried a lot of different things, she's never really settled on something for more than one album at a time. Her discography, when you review it in hindsight, is so disjointed. I really noticed that when I saw the set list that she put together for the It's Not That Deep tour. Really Don't Care is neither a pop nor a rock song. It's certainly not an EDM or a dance song, but it's one of the songs from her back catalog that she tries to kind of shoehorn into whatever the It's Not That Deep set list is. And when I saw the It's Not That Deep tour, I realized Demi really didn't have a vision for this. The album art, the creative direction has all been very, what's cool on TikTok? What did Charlie XCX do? What did Dua Lipa do, actually? It really seems like Demi's creative direction North Star here was Dua Lipa's Radical Optimism. And Radical Optimism wasn't even a particularly inspired record. So I don't know why we're pulling on that for inspiration. But the staging that she's put together for the It's Not That Deep tour, the way the set list is going, the fact that she doesn't have a live band, the hideous costumes, I'm like, oh, so there really wasn't a vision behind this. Say what you want about CXOXO. She comes to me like a vision. I keep coming back to her. There's more to discover and discuss about CXOXO. Say what you want about CXOXO. There was a fully realized creative visual thing. All of those music videos have a very specific aesthetic, and you don't need a big budget to do it. A lot of people will say, It's Not That Deep didn't do that well. The tour budget got slashed. Well, look at what Slater's doing, Worst Girl in America. You don't need $1 million to come up with a coherent vision. And Demi's vision just seems to be, I'm going to serve, because that's what everyone else is doing. And the one thing that seems to be really serving about this tour is her vocals. And this kind of music that she's doing right now doesn't even really support the kind of singing that she's really good at that people love to hear from her anyway. This era of dance music also doesn't feel very aligned with where Demi's actually at in her life. If you're launching your I'm a Cool It Girl album, it's kind of a little bit lame to also be launching a cookbook at the same time. Do you see the cognitive dissonance between those two things? I'm not saying that those two things can't exist in one person at the same time. They absolutely can. And I understand her story about, finding a way to have a better relationship with food and all of that. But doing it at the same time as the album, it's not a great creative strategy. I don't think it helps the book sales, and I don't think it helps the album sales. It makes you look confused. It makes you look like you're throwing spaghetti at a wall and trying to see what's gonna stick. You also only get so many chances to say, this is the real me. This is the real work that I love to do. And I think Demi used a lot of that cachet on her rock era. And mostly people believed it, but they just didn't like it that much or stream it or stay attuned to the holy fuck era. It didn't do very well. But the answer to that is not to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater and do a 180 from what you were doing before, because this just feels, again, so market calibrated, so intentionally cooked up by a group of people who said, Demi needs to have a moment. How do we rescue her career? This was one way to try and go about doing it, and I don't think that it's worked personally. It doesn't resonate because it doesn't feel aligned with the life that she's actually living. I mean, Demi is a person who is very actively in recovery. She's sober. She's married. These songs about staying up all night and going out and really making music that is supposed to be played on a dance floor at the club, again, it feels incongruous with who the artist we know is purporting themselves to be. And in pop, authenticity is kind of key and king right now. There are pluses and minuses to that being the case. But specifically for Demi Lovato, that is becoming her main challenge. Who are you? Why are you doing this? So my advice to Demi, find your why. Since I keep bringing her up, why don't we talk about Camila Cabello? Keep being weird. For the love of God, Camila, do not go back to chasing the Havana formula. Don't let a label get in your ear and tell you that you need Bomb Bomb again. You've got the billions of stream songs. You've got the hits that you need to play a 5-song set at the iHeartRadio Music Festival. Lean into what you started with CXOXO. It flopped and failed because it wasn't brave enough. It didn't push past the barrier of an aesthetic reinvention. It flirted with it. I thought the most interesting thing about CXOXO was that she was really trying to nail down a soundscape for what Miami, her version of Miami, felt like to her when she was a young girl and growing up and getting lost and finding herself in this city, also returning there after this rocket ship to fame that she went on and eventually had a break from after this huge like relationship ending moment, band ending moment. She was in a real moment of transition. And I think that she just didn't really go there. It seems almost like she's holding back or that she's hiding behind the aesthetic reinvention to mask the personal transformation that's going on. If we could have welded those two things and been a little bit more confessional, I have to return to Slater's Worst Girl in America, a song like Brittany Murphy here. There is a way to do this kind of aesthetic pivot, this kind of ironic detachment, while also imbuing it with a really sincere take on where your life is and where you've been and how you feel about it. I don't think that Camila Cabello perfectly struck that balance. I think there was still part of her that was trying to get a hit on this record, very clearly by the Charlie influenced I Love It and the frequent inclusions of Drake. You can't tell me that Camila authentically wanted to collaborate with Drake on this. She wanted a hit, and this was before Drake was getting in all the hot water. Unfortunately, by the time the project came out, that was counterproductive to the success of the album. Some might say it contributed to the flop, but I would like Camila to be braver, darker, weirder. I think that being an independent artist would actually be great for her because it would free her from the shackles of thinking that she has to be a main pop girl at all. Camila, you need to make like Kim Petras and Freak It. It's only fair that we're talking about Camila Cabello and we progress to Shawn Mendes. Shawn Mendes, here is my unsolicited advice for you as a pop star. Dumb and Poetic clocked you in a way that you haven't recovered from. Newsflash, we are not interested in hearing rich, white, straight men sing about taking psychedelics for the first time. Newsflash, it's boring. Newsflash, the Beatles did it first, and every other attempt is boring unless you are also taking psychedelics at the very same time, which most of us are not when we're listening to a Shawn Mendes album. Shawn Mendes is proof that the pretty privilege can run out, the gorgeous face card can decline. I think Shawn was destined to be a YouTube covers artist. When I see him, I think entertainer, I don't see artist. And his entire career flop and pivot into flopdom and boringdom has been when he has taken the creative control, when he's taken the reins and said, I have something to say. It's like Kronk from The Emperor's New Groove being given a blackboard and a piece of chalk and told to come up with an equation that's gonna change the world. It's not possible, it's not within you, my beloved. So what should you do instead, Shawn Mendes? Go back to the label and ask them to give you a hit. Really? That's it. That is what the doctor ordered. If you insist on being involved in the process, perhaps you can sit in the room. Perhaps you can change a word or two here to get your writing credit. But we don't want to hear a song called Why. If you can't answer that question, how the hell are we? Shawn Mendes is more of an entertainer than an artist, and many actively producing artists would fare better if they would accept that they are entertainers. Someone who I think used to accept that she was an entertainer and not an artist is J-Lo, but when she tried to become an artist and do her latest flop, This Is Me Now album, look what happened. Look what happens when you give an entertainer the artist's tools. Also, Shawn Mendes, your affiliations with the failing John Mayer, who hasn't written an interesting song in years, certainly doesn't help you. No one wants to hear about you taking psychedelics and saying they changed your life. Nobody wants to hear about how awesome and gnarly it is to surf, bro. We want to hear about if you're fruity or not. You said that you might be, and I think that was to drum up interest in your album, but the only way you're going to get us back on board is if you go back to the label and you say, give me a fruity hit. Give me a fruity hit. Ask for the Harry Styles special. Taylor Swift. Dear Taylor Swift, this is my unsolicited advice. I think that you need to go back to the drawing board. No, it's true. I really think that we need a creative reset in a way that we haven't needed one since Lover. We are at a point now where I think we are at the end of something. Life of a Showgirl really feels like the end of this era of hyperproduction. It started with Folklore and it devolved into the Life of a Showgirl. The problem with the Life of a Showgirl is that it has none of the really charming aspects of what makes Taylor Swift a good writer. It has some flashes of the things that make her a good writer or a listenable writer, but what truly makes her excellent is displayed nowhere on this record. record. And that is very disappointing when you have built your entire career off of being a very specific kind of writer that is very in touch with what needs to be said at every juncture in your career. Taylor's instinct to want to control everything creatively, especially after losing the rights to her master recordings, totally makes sense to me from a personal and emotional basis. She doesn't ever want to be in a position where someone else can come and take credit for her work or take it away from her ever again. That makes sense. She went to great lengths to make sure that her rightful work that she created came back to her. However, I think that she has essentially locked herself in a room with the same three or four people, and there is a lot of interesting things to be found outside of that room. Taylor Swift is an artist who knows how to challenge herself, and she knows when it's time to mix things up. After the Torture Poets Department, I think she's doing what she did with Lover post-Reputation. Torture Poets was a polarizing album. It contained a lot of confession. It humiliated her in certain ways. It contained admissions that I think she maybe would rather have not shared, but had to for her own creative process, hence why the album is so cathartic and amazing. The Life of a Showgirl is such a retreat from that kind of confession and a little bit of a reorientation. I understand it as a palate cleanser. Also, when we're 12 albums in, it's okay to have a bad album. It's okay to have a reset album. It's okay to have a start over album. But I would implore her to remember how it felt to contact Aaron Dessner, someone, and Bon Iver, people that she'd never worked with before and she'd always wanted to work with or felt that she was, you know, not good enough to work with, to shoot your shot in the middle of a creative change or a creative limbo after Lover and before she really became acclaimed again and taken seriously as an adult artist by the critics in the industry. I would really encourage her to revisit how it felt, how inspired she became, all the opportunities that it opened up for her to delve into a new creative and collaborative process with a new approach and a fresh perspective. We need to leave Max Martin behind, Jack Antonoff behind, and Aaron Dessner behind, and look abroad for greener pastures. Doing the same thing over and over again yields the same results. I think that it's time for Taylor to try something new, and it's completely within her wheelhouse to do so. I have full confidence that she will do it eventually. I don't know if it's going to be on this next record or if it's going to take her a little bit of time. I personally think that she should take some time away from creating music just to come back with a fresh perspective. This automatic songwriting thing that she's developed where she writes and releases, it returns me back to that problem I talked about with Justin Bieber and Swag. It's a great impulse creatively to create like that. However, the fine tooth comb needs to come in at the end and whittle it all down. My fear about how Taylor approached The Life of a Showgirl was, I want to make a short and condensed album was the mission statement going in. And so she made 12 songs and stopped. It wasn't like Red or 1989, where she has this vault of things that were left off for this or that reason, very intentional, specifically calibrated to the project reasons. She just took whatever was available. That is the impression I got of how this track list was created. I don't think there was anything left on the cutting room floor. And we need to have a cutting room floor for Taylor Swift. I really do. I think that's where we get the best work. If you want to do something tight and considered, you got to write a lot to get there. I understand Life of a Showgirl, she was tired, she was in the middle of tour, but we need to get up on our good foot. That's my personal opinion. Katy Perry. I don't want to say this, but I really think it might have to be give up. She's run out of chances to make it happen. And I've seen comments that she's made going back and forth about this new era that she's gone through, 143. It doesn't instill me with confidence that she really has a great perspective to share or offer with us. I really do think she's just a rich, out of touch Californian woman who was never really that creative to begin with and was really just kind of in the right place at the right time with the right amount of hunger and pizzazz and a good charisma. She's a great showman, another entertainer, not an artist. Band-Aids was all right, but does anyone care? There comes a point where you simply DTM. You do too much, you try too hard, you fail too greatly, and there is no road back for you. I'm not interested in hearing anything else from Katy Perry. I've personally given all the grace I can give. I've run out of patience for Katy Perry. I don't even know if I would tune in to a new album. What am I kidding? Yes, I would. I would tune in to throw my tomatoes. I would have to. It's my job. Let's talk about Tate McRae. Tate McRae is also at a bit of an interesting part in her career, so close to what I think was her I Made It moment. The album definitely seemed to be popular with people. It definitely streamed. Do I think that it was a well-written album? Well, no, but there were some pretty iconic songs. Sports Car is iconic to me. Tate McRae, my unsolicited advice for you as a lover of pop music is I would like to see you continue with narrative singles and with world building. I wanna see you come up with a project that is front to back, start to finish, a vision. And that vision doesn't have to be anything really serious. The vision can be, I love to dance and go out at night and I hate my ex-boyfriend and that really would be enough for me. I just wanna see a sustained thought from track 1 to track 10 or track 12, whatever it may be. I think the focus that we saw on So Close to What Deluxe is a good example of how Tate can put her head down and focus on something. However, I do think that it was a little bit boring. There was a sameness quality to it that Gracie Abrams tends to have that comes from working with the same people over and over. But the most promising sign for Tate McRae's future career, I think, is Tit for Tat. Tit for Tat, I think, was one of her biggest single debuts, or it was tied with the one that Morgan Wallen got on the charts too, which we pretend doesn't exist. But Tit for Tat charted a lot higher than any of the singles on So Close to What, and that's because it leveraged on a very specific moment. It took advantage of the fact that she was on tour and that she was viral constantly 24/7. Whenever Tate performs, it's going to go viral. And also the fact that she broke up with her boyfriend. Nobody knows her boyfriend, really. People don't really care about that, but they do care about the fact that they broke up. That is interesting, especially because they've been public together. So now you have attention. You have a personal storyline that people are invested in. We would like to hear more about it. Something that I thought was interesting, a bright spark on the So Close to What Deluxe Edition, was Nobody's Girl. That was an interesting sonic experimentation. The most interesting of all the deluxe tracks to me. And I think if she, I'm not opposed to her continuing to collaborate with Ryan Tedder, because I think that he really has finally cracked with her. Just Keep Watching, Tit for Tat, Nobody's Girl. He's cracked what's really good for Tate McRae. I'm not ready to give up his production work yet, but I either want Tate to focus on really doing something that's specific to her, or to actually herself investigate her Y2K references a little bit more, because other people are bringing those references to the production and she's not bringing them to the vocal delivery or to the songs. So let's align those perspectives, mama. My unsolicited pop star advice for Dua Lipa is the same advice I gave to Madison Beer. It's time to get ugly. It's time to get ugly. It's time to bare your teeth a little bit. It's time to make us interested in what you do. Dua Lipa is a little too perfect. She, in another life, is an amazing influencer. Actually, in her current life, she is an amazing influencer, because it's been a minute since Radical Optimism came out and she was still touring it up until about 5 minutes ago. So I think that if she took a break from the polished pop perfection thing, she would avoid the influencer criticism. And I would like to see her take a risk. Radical Optimism really played it safe after Future Nostalgia's very aesthetic, curated moment. I wouldn't call Future Nostalgia any sort of sonic experimentation. I don't think that it was very different. I think it leveraged a lot of interesting trends that were happening right around that time when it came out in 2020. And it came out at the perfect time when we were all looking for an album that was about physical connection and the dance floor and being sweaty and being close to people and having emotions while doing all of that. That was an interesting moment for her to come out with. I think that Radical Optimism really floated off of the goodwill that came along with Future Nostalgia. And I think that in this next experiment, she has such great aesthetic influences. And she spoke about so many different sonic influences when she was talking about Radical Optimism, which makes me question her taste as an auteur. You know, I don't think she's good at really picking sounds or understanding what sounds are, because she was saying that that album was influenced by Britpop and nothing on it sounds anything like that. So she needs to talk to Charlie and figure out how to take a reference that you admire and actually work it into the stuff that you're producing. But Charlie's hyper-pop pivot really saved her career in the long run. Caroline Polachek's avant-garde pop. These are things that I think Dua Lipa could aspire to. Not to do the exact same thing as, but little resets in her sound that could be done. Do you think that there is a specific Dua Lipa sound? Does Dua Lipa have a sonic footprint that is familiar to you when you hear it before you even hear her voice, the production style? I don't think so. I don't think that she has that clarity of intention that flows through her entire discography. You get bits and pieces of it. Don't Start Now, to me, is the closest that we get to it, but it quickly disappeared on Radical Optimism because it felt like she was just trying to recapture that same magic over and over again. Houdini is a great example of that. I want to finish with Conan Gray. People keep asking me to review. People keep asking me to listen. I don't need to. I know what's going on. It's the same thing every time. Go and take a literature class and go and take a songwriting class. Do what Olivia Rodrigo did in between Sour and Guts and go and enroll in a poetry class and learn how to write something that doesn't just come out of your notes app. There's a difference between the poetry of Sylvia Plath and the poetry of Jake Shane's notes app on Instagram. Conan Gray is closer towards the Jake Shane notes app poetry, which is really... poetry is a strong word to describe that, but Conan Gray really is closer to that than he is to Sylvia Plath. I'm not saying you gotta be Sylvia Plath, but if you wanna be, again, a diaristic confessional songwriter, you need to be generating some interesting insights. It can't be, I got drunk off of vodka cranberry. That's not that interesting. The raw materials are there. He's got the talent. He's got the voice. He can carry an era visually. I think he's good at branding. He clearly has good marketing instincts, But the kind of music that he wants to do, he's woefully ill-equipped skills-wise, which is why he sees successful after successful release that does not shift the needle of the wider pop ecosystem accepting him and appreciating him and having a breakout moment. People keep asking, why isn't he a star? Why doesn't he have a moment? We need a pop boy. Because it's the same thing over and over again. He might change up the aesthetic of it from Super Egg to whatever he's doing now. He does change up how it looks and he does change up some of the sonic influences, but Conan Gray couldn't do an entire album with Max Martin and get a hit or even get something that sounds distinctly and uniquely Conan Gray. That alerts to me that you are not doing your job right as the artist. I think he really needs to express more of an interest in the creative process that goes out of just being a self-indulgent creator. And this is an issue that I've noticed with a lot of Gen Z writers, even outside of songwriting. A lot of Gen Z, they just think that if they say how they feel and they say it clearly and they have no polish and no filter, that automatically means that it's important or that it's powerful or that it's profound literature. But to make something profound, to make writing good, you're transforming the personal into the universal. So you need to take a detail and make it an insight. You don't just share the detail and go, there it is, that's the insight. You have to do the work of making it art. And a lot of these singer-songwriters are not doing that work. So my best advice to Conan Gray would be, go take a couple of classes, read some more books, study. All right, I think that's all I have time for today. I definitely didn't go through everyone on my list. I might save that for another video if you guys are interested. If you liked this one, let me know. Did you disagree with anything that I said? Do you have anything to add? I would love to hear from you in the comments below, and I will see you in my next video. Goodbye.